This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The year is 1992. And look, up in the sky, it's a pig. It's a plane. Oh, actually, it's a pig in a plane. The movie, Porco Rosso.
Everyone, and welcome to
Unspooled.
I'm Amy Nicholson.
And I'm Paul Scheer, and this is the podcast where we are trying to find the best movies ever made. And when we do, we will fire them off into space to either kill aliens or enlighten them to what Amy and I believe are the classics, the true classics. And you know, Amy, throughout the show, we have not spent that much time in animation. And this month, we've been delving deep into animation, different types of animation. How are you enjoying your animation?
I am enjoying it. We've been taking some unexpected turns, I would say. At first, I was like, what are we going to do for animation? Are we just going to do Fantasia because it was kicked off the original AFI list? What? I mean, the world of animation is so big. And I feel like we've been picking some unusual films within it. And I have been enjoying this strange and twisty ride.
Yeah, I mean, today's film is Porco Rosso, which is our first Miyazaki film. And I'll just talk about how we came to this conclusion to pick this film. When we...
You and I argued for like hours and hours and hours over weeks.
Well, yeah, we were getting into it, but we wanted to make sure that we represented a choice that was not overdone. And when we let the listeners kind of vote, one of the things that kept on coming up was... You can't do Spirited Away and you can't do Totoro because they've been done, talked about to death. Not that they aren't great, but we would love to hear a different discussion. And I think that really resonated with both of us. Like the idea, like, yes, I know we've talked about The Godfather in the show and Star Wars in the show. Those are movies that are overdone as well. But for this month, I thought it was fun to maybe veer off the beaten path a little bit. And the clear winner, which is a movie that I never heard of, this Porco Rosso, was right there waiting for us. So that's how we picked it. But I was surprised because I thought, oh, maybe it would be Ponyo. Maybe it would be like other movies that I'd heard of. But this seems to have a lot of heat behind it. And I know that you have a very interesting story about Porco.
Oh, well, Porco Rosso is a movie that I think I never quite believed was a movie until we just watched it. Because what happened is when I was a little kid, I was really into everything Japanese. And my dad bought me a Christmas present. He went to a store and he was like, my daughter likes Japanese things. What do I get at the mall? And they gave him a DVD of Porco Rosso, except they explained it to him as like, it's sort of like a computer game. I don't know, because they gave it to him at a time when DVDs were not common and we didn't own a DVD player. And it was just a...
Whoa, I didn't know that part of the story. Yeah, that's even crazy. Okay.
I didn't know what a DVD was and neither did my dad. And it was explained really strangely. And so he came home and gave it to me for Christmas. And like, you know, it was just this like box that had a pig on the cover of it and the pig looked like it was flying. And my dad said it was a computer game and I didn't know how to play it. And I was terrified I was going to break it. So I just left it in the wrapping, not knowing what this thing was. It became this like entertainment totem of my life, of like this box that was still in the plastic wrap that I carried around because I became terrified that if I opened it, I would destroy it somehow. And I didn't know what it was. And then even after like I learned what a DVD player was, I didn't have the courage to unwrap it and figure out whether or not this was a DVD. I don't know why. It became this like thing that I will never unwrap and could never unwrap because I just was terrified. It's like having like the dancing frog in the box and like, what if it's not a DVD? What if it is a video game? I know this is sounding psychotic, but basically I carried this like shrink-wrapped Porco Rosso DVD around for like 15 years.
I love that it came with you. It came with you wherever you went.
Yeah, it seemed like so valuable that I didn't ever want to find out what it was. And so I finally like sold it when it was still in shrink wrap because I was really, really poor. And so I sold it to the Amoeba Records here in Hollywood because I didn't know what else to do with it. And I knew in my soul that I would never find out what was inside this box. So that is what happened. And then, yeah.
This is it. We got here. By the way, as I'm hearing that story, I'm realizing that your dad probably bought like a Region 2 DVD. Like, because I imagine if it's from Japan, maybe they didn't. Or who knows? I mean,
Right. Because in researching this, I realized that like the DVD release here wasn't until like way after my dad gave me this. So it was probably something we couldn't even play here anyways. And like, maybe that would explain the fraught manner in which it was explained to my dad and like the tension that he imbued in this box when he gave it to me. And also, now that I think about it, what a dick move to sell my dad something that we clearly couldn't play.
Right.
But really, so there's just, it's been strange. I've had this weird relationship with this movie in my head, like still not believing it was a movie till I watched it and like feeling guilt that I never watched it before and wondering what would happen if I had discovered Miyazaki when I was in high school instead of like much later.
Well, this is fascinating. And I think there's only one thing we can do, which is unspool it. The year is 1992. The nicotine patch hits the market. Euro Disney in France opens. Bill Clinton's elected president. Minnesota's Mall of America is constructed, spanning 78 acres. DNA fingerprinting is invented. And the hot films include films that we've done here on the show: A League of Their Own, Unforgiven, Basic Instinct, which we've not done, and today's film, Porco Rosso. Amy, tell us who's in it, what's it about, and more importantly, 92, that's a banger year. What was on the radio?
Porco Rosso. It is written and directed by Hayao Miyazaki. Miyazaki is, of course, the great Japanese animator who co-founded Studio Ghibli and made major films there. Totoro, Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, Ponyo, Kiki's Delivery Service, on and on and on and on and on. Most of his big films that have hit here are about like young girls in fantastical situations. But Porco Rosso is the closest film that Miyazaki ever made to his own self-portrait. Like, true story, when Miyazaki does, like, little doodles of himself, he draws himself as a pig. And also, Porco Rosso is the only film that Miyazaki has openly said that he wants to someday make a sequel to, which may or may not happen, depending on, like, how many more times he wants to retire. He likes to retire and then come back out again. Porco Rosso is set in...
He's like the Tom Brady of the animation world.
You know, I don't know if that phrase has ever been used for him before, but he should coin it.
That's our new shirt. We have not made a new shirt in a while. Miyazaki is the Tom Brady of the animation world.
Are we going to draw him as a really buff pig? How is this going to work?
Pig skin, pig man.
Oh,
I like
God.
It.
Pig skin, pig man. You're right. Pig skin, pig man, Pygmalion.
Okay. You have Tom Brady throwing a football that looks like Miyazaki as a pig. This is a million-dollar idea.
The man loves flying. He's
there
flying
it is.
In the air. What? Okay. Well, so Porco Rosso is set in 1929. It's set kind of in and above the Adriatic Sea. That's like the sea between Italy and what is now Croatia during the gap between World War I and World War II. Porco, born Marco, is a 30-something seaplane pilot who used to fight in the Italian army, and the war turned him into a pig, both figuratively, as he is a cynical, sexist, heavy-drinking, emotionally wounded man who no longer believes in anything, including himself, and also literally. He is a pig. He walks around. He's a pig. He has a snout, and everybody else in the movie is human. Yet the movie is about how, through the eyes of the people who care about him, especially two women, Gina, his childhood friend who runs this very cool nightclub that I would love to go to, and Fio, a teen girl who also happens to be a brilliant engineer, Through them, we see glimpses of the man that Porco could still be. Take a listen.
Porco Rosso, Miyazaki's soaring action adventure of a valiant pilot.
Here we go. It is Porco.
Transformed by a mysterious spell.
I only look out for myself.
And his heroic battles to rid the skies of notorious pirates.
Slice them into bacon!
Full of courage and humor.
I'll tell everyone you're chicken!
Chicken, pig, what's the difference?
Take flight with the incredible Porco Rosso.
Porco Rosso was released in 1992 as a special in-flight movie for Japan Air. And then later, it was released in theaters, and much later, it was released here. It was a huge success in Japan. Like, at the box office, it beat not just Hook, but Beauty and the Beast. It was the number one movie that year. It set a domestic record that didn't get broken for a very long time, I think until Titanic. Porco Rosso made it to the United States on December 16th, 1994, where very few people saw it at the time. But over the decades, its reputation has grown and grown and grown and grown. What were people busy doing instead of seeing Porco Rosso on December 16th, 1994? Well, according to the number one song on the Billboard charts that weekend, they were rocking out to a song that, yes, Paul, still totally crushes. Eni Kamoze, Here Comes the Hot Summer.
No, no, we don't die. Yes, we multiply. And in one press we'll hear the fine lady sing. Act like you know, Rico. I know. Them up and go. Oh, cha cha ching ching. Here come the hot stepper. I'm the lyrical gangster. Excuse me, Mr. Officer. Still love you like that.
Oh, classic.
Yeah, I will say they do have one thing in common, Eni Kamoze, Here Comes the Hot Stepper, and Porco Rosso. I will say this, they are both works of art that love idioms. You know, if Porco Rosso is all about, like, when pigs fly, Eni Kamoze, in that clip we just hear, he's just waiting to hear that fat lady sing. That's a stretch. I'll take.
You know, look. You know what? Look. You know what? I'm going to buy it because you sold it with such conviction. Honestly, that's all I can ask for here. This is a really interesting movie, in the sense that I didn't know it existed, and it feels so drastically different than all of his other films. You talked about this in the beginning that. You know, he normally has female protagonists, but this movie, in a way, is like an adult film marketed towards kids. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. Like Miyazaki is a guy who has really strong opinions on what kind of movies kids should watch or what's mm-hmm. good for kids.
Well, this is perfect for a fodder for us, as we've gotten into this many a time.
Well, then maybe we should trust him in what he says, you know, because his view on kids' films, having made some of the most massive kids' films, I don't know if you ever went to the Miyazaki museum exhibit that we have here at the Academy Museum right now.
I heard it's amazing.
Like, it's very cool. Kids running under all of his trees and playing around. But he said, like, the main difference between, like, him and John Lasseter, you know, who he was comparing himself mm-hmm. to at the time, is that John Lasseter wants to guide children. He wants to get lost with children. You know, he says that with children, you really do have to aim for their heads. You should not decide for a kid what is too much for them to handle, that children are really wise. And he really feels like with a kid movie, it's okay to take on serious topics, but what you really specifically have to do that he tries not to do is to simplify something serious, to sentimentalize something serious, or he never, ever tries to solve something serious and make it be like, it's going to be okay. Here's how it gets resolved. So he's like, you can show kids things like, you know, the environment. We have to take care of the environment. But he's not going to do it in easy ways where, like, here's Mr. Mean Tree Guy, you know, and da-da-da, we saved the planet. Or here in this movie, he talks about war and he talks about fascism, but he doesn't make it, you know, easy. He just sort of is presenting how these things exist and showing you characters tangling with it and kind of treating kids like adults who can figure out what they think.
I totally agree with that. The idea that, you know, an adult movie for kids can work on two levels because the story is always going to be fulfilling. Like, they understand the beginning, middle, and end. They may not see all the nuance in it, but they can at least go along for the journey. And as you get older, you can see the bigger story, like the more adult themes. And I think that's a really tricky thing to figure out how to do, how to keep something interesting for kids, but also you know, as rich and full for adults. That makes for a great, what I've been talking about, family movie, where you can go there and leave with two totally different experiences, but come out loving it just the same.
No, that's true. Because like the setting of this movie, you know, between wars, you know, in a movie where like you're watching and knowing that like a new war is going to happen, what I respect about his approach is like Miyazaki doesn't condescend to anybody in the audience and say like, this pig can save war or prevent war, but he also doesn't sugarcoat things. I feel like this is a movie that doesn't lie to you, right? Because to take one character as an example, like you're aware that war is coming, you're seeing more fascists on the streets in Italy, you know, there's lots to talk about, you know, later on in this episode about like Porco himself and how he feels about the government. But you have like a girl in the movie, you know, the girl Fio, who's like an Italian and a great airplane designer. And we know at the end of the movie through her epilogue, she's going to keep making airplanes and she's going to keep making them in Italy, which means she's probably making military planes for like the Italian government during World War II. And that's pretty dark. And he doesn't like lie about it, but he doesn't really talk about it either. He just presents it as though it is a thing that will happen.
Wow, that's actually a lot darker than I even realized. I didn't think it all the way through, but you're right.
It's kind of like people you love can also do things you don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big
believer in that you don't have to agree with a person's perspective on everything to be their friend, to be in relation with them. It helps. But I do think it's important to embrace differences. And talking about differences, I mean, our lead character here is a pig. And not a pig for comedic sake, right? It's not like, oh, isn't this cute? He is someone who has been affected by something. I think this character being a pig is a physical representation of guilt and loss, right? And in a way, I was thinking about it, and tell me if I'm totally off base, but the idea that he feels like a pig because he survived this horrible battle where his friends died, and he kind of is greedily eating more life. So it's sort of like he feels like a pig, like, you know, that he's getting to gorge himself on living or something in there. Does that connect to you at all? Or do you think, I mean,
I'm trying to understand why gorging it, but I think I like that gorging image. Cause I mean, that's the first thing we see of him. He's like a guy who has carved for himself this little nook of life where it's him, a bottle of wine, he's smoking, he's reading magazines.
And
he
he's
doesn't
positioned
be bothered
like a pig.
He wants to be bothered.
Like he's positioned like a pig on a beach, belly up he's not in the sand, but he's in a chair in the sand. Like the way that you would see a pig in a sty, right? Like they love the sun there. And obviously there are elements here. Like, is he acting like a pig or is he acting like a human? I don't know. But there is that idea that he is living that life and has no true, like he doesn't seem like he has any passion. He's great at flying and he has a passion for putting himself into dangerous situations to help save others. But that seems like his only true passion.
Yeah. And even the helping is kind of like, okay, because I can. You know, not
right.
Like I must. It's not like I have to save the day. It's like, all right.
Yeah.
Mr. Rosso, we've got a job for you. The Mama Ayuto gang is on the move.
The Mama Ayuto gang? I don't know. Kind of busy.
We need you to protect one of our ships that's carrying a fortune in gold.
Is that all?
Well, there's a group of schoolgirls on board, too.
Now that is going to cost you.
I mean, that idea of feeling greedy about living, I like that. That's interesting, because one of the things about this movie is they never tell you why he's a pig.
Right.
You know, there's somebody mentions briefly that it was a curse, but they don't say who put the curse and blah, blah, blah. I feel like you kind of understand that maybe he put the curse on himself. I mean, one of the theories that, you know, is actually just said in the film's promotional booklet, which is not on screen, but they say in the booklet that he turned himself into a pig because he wanted to get out of being in the army, which to me, it sounds almost like the hijinks we would have seen in MASH or something like
that. Right, right.
And that would explain one of the interesting things about him, which is he is a pig. He seems aware that he's a pig, not super stoked on it, but he also doesn't seem tormented. You know, this isn't like
Morbius
or something. Like, oh no, if only I weren't a pig. Or he's not even
You see that torment when he's crossed out his face.
Well, you see, but he crosses out being a human. Like he's what I guess I'm trying to say is like he's not trying to. There is no plot line in here of how can I not be a pig.
Right. I see what you're saying. Okay. Right. So I think it pains him to look at the old version of himself, which, again, I keep on going back to this idea that the torment that we're feeling is I am no longer this guy. And looking at this guy, I can't be this young, naive, cocksure pilot anymore. Right. I am this other thing. And this guilt of whether maybe he was better than his co-pilots that made him survive, or maybe it was luck. And I think this movie balances that a lot between being lucky and being really good at being a pilot. But the idea that if you're lucky and good in war, you're going to feel a tremendous amount of grief, and you're going to start to carry that grief with you and on you, and it will kind of erase who you are. And that's what I think we're talking about on some level. Like, he is erased who he is because he's no longer that innocent. We talked about this in Platoon and things like that, but like he is affected. And sometimes being good and being lucky alienates you from the rest of the world. And this movie is about him finding a genuine connection again, I think, on some level.
Yeah, I mean, going on that, like I would say he doesn't scratch out his face because seeing his human face reminds him how miserable he is to have the face he has now. It's like he's embarrassed of that guy. He's like embarrassed of the human guy, you know? Like, he doesn't want to see that guy's face because he doesn't like remembering who he was back then or something. I mean, the one thing that we know about that picture is he's basically, out of all of those guys around in the army flying planes, he's the only one of his friends who is alive. Like his last living friend from that period, you know, is Gina. They knew each other when they were like 17 and flying on planes. And he's like, "Woo! I see the wind in your skirt and I see all your pantaloons." But she, you know, says like basically every other man I have loved who is a pilot has died.
What do you think of that American flyboy? He's something else, isn't he? As soon as he saw me, he asked me to marry him. So I told him of the three pilots I've married. The first died in the war. The second died in the Atlantic. The last one, he died in Asia.
So you've heard something.
I got the call last night. They found his remains in some remote part of Bengal. It's strange, Marco. I've been waiting to hear something for 3 years, but now I can't even cry. I just feel numb. Maybe I've run out of tears.
Yeah, well, the good guys always die. Cheers to a good man.
And his last line there, I think, is really telling. Like, he's like, the good ones die. You know, and if the good ones die, what does that say about him? Or what does that say about how he thinks about himself? That he doesn't think he's one of the good ones because he survived.
Yeah, I think that there's a glory in that. Like, yeah, like there.
Yeah.
Well, I think the longer that you live in life, you know, the more tragedy you will experience just because you're living, right? And that idea that he deserves to be a pig. Right. He deserves to be alone. He isn't worthy of company because he can't or doesn't want to ever be connected again to something that will break his heart. Right. That's what I'm kind of feeling is like he isolates himself because he is trying to isolate himself from being hurt. And you see that the way that he interacts with almost everyone, it's distant. And the only time that you really see him connect in that clip that you just played is over loss, over mourning, over the idea that aren't we the unfortunate people that we're alive? And the woman that he talks with, she doesn't have that same attitude. She obviously carries the weight of grief, but at the same time is still living life. Or at least that's what I get from them, like the two of them together.
Yeah. Or on that note, but just like slightly twisted off, what if he prefers being a pig to being a human? Because he doesn't seem to like humanity very much. He seems to love having the pig excuse to get himself out of the things that humans are supposed to do, like be in the military or donate to a war fund or, you know, have all these responsibilities that he just thinks are dumb. Like, I think he like deflects using this like pig identity not to have to deal with any of the stuff that humans have to do. I mean, I wonder if on some level he feels like being a pig is just more honest, like that it's better to walk around the world knowing that you are a pig, rather than like deluding yourself into thinking that you're some great, you know, Italian war hero, you know, some great like victor of the skies.
Yeah, because where's the joy in killing others, right? Where's the joy in taking a life? And I think that there's that weight that we talk about a lot with war films. And it's interesting because is Miyazaki, does he have that background? Does he have that connection?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, Miyazaki, whew. When it comes to Miyazaki talking about like war and the people who are involved in war and the complications of like what it's like to just be born in a country doing horrible things when you're born there, that is his whole backstory. So, I mean, this is a guy who was born in Tokyo in 1941. You know, war is still going on. His dad makes airplanes. His dad is the director of a company called Miyazaki Airplanes. It's like his dad and his uncle. And Miyazaki Airplanes, being in Japan in the 1940s, they're making military planes for World War II. They're specifically making like the rudder of the plane. That's their whole job. But his dad is a person who is making, you know, equipment for military planes that will bomb Pearl Harbor. You know, his family is responsible for making planes that, you know, did become like kamikaze planes. And it's tough. He feels like all sorts of conflicting emotions, you know, like, yes, it is his dad and it is his job. And it's just what happens when you're born there. I mean, I feel like a lot of us having lived through, you know, the Trump years now have, I think, a deeper understanding of what is it like to live in a country doing things that you don't agree with? Like, what do you do? What do you start to do? Like, right. What if things have gotten worse? And that's what he's born into. I mean, because not only is his dad's job, but because it is his dad's job, he's able to grow up, you know, pretty well off at a time when a lot of kids are hungry. When people start firebombing, when there's American raids in Tokyo, like he's able to escape, you know, he's able to move outside of Tokyo and be able to grow up a little bit safer there because his family has money, because they have money, because they're making like war planes. And I think this really weighs on him for, I mean, honestly, up until today, like he is such a strong pacifist that, you know, when he was nominated for an Oscar, you know, at the 75th Oscars here in Hollywood in 2003, he wouldn't go because he wanted to protest the Iraq war. He did not want to visit a country that was bombing another country. And in fact, that's the same dynamic that's happening here when he makes Porco Rosso, is that, you know, 1990, 1991, the U.S. is starting the Gulf War. We're fighting in the Gulf. And this is a thing that really affects him, you know, countries bombing each other. And he, like, I think he has always used his art and his microphone to talk about this, like, kind of dilemma of, like, what war does to people, what it does to the people who are sort of forced to get caught up into it. I mean, later on, when he makes, you know, The Wind Rises, that's all about it. Like, that's the story of, like, an actual Japanese airplane engineer who has to work with the government and feels terrible that his, like, planes are used for war. So it's his whole backstory. And I think he has this really personal front row view of just wrestling with all of these complications. You can't control where you're born, you know?
Right.
And you can't control what you love to do. And you can't control, like, having a thing you love in a country that then makes a radical shift. Or can you? Can you? Should you? Like, what? Like, can you? I think there's not just, it's not like a knee-jerk justification. It's like a lot of guilt involved.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
What's interesting about Miyazaki and the little bit of research that I did here was that he also loves planes, these instruments of war. Like, right, I mean, they're beautiful flying machines, but they can be, like, there's this true fascination with this culture and tanks and seeing them, you know, do what they do. So it's a really... It's interesting because he's living on like both sides of the coin, right? It was like, I want to make something frivolous. I want to show machines and tanks and embrace this idea of war. And I think we see this a lot in old, you know, 1940s films from Hollywood too. There's this, you know, pride in a time where we all were, people were working together, and, you know, animation's obviously a giant group of team members getting together to make a vision. And that's what, you know, in many respects, and I'm oversimplifying it, I know, but like what you do when you are in a, you know, a unit, an army unit, like you are together in a unit, you're fighting together, you're trying to accomplish a goal. So I understand like where there's a connection and why he maybe even, you know, connects to the animation world, because there are certain elements that overlap. So I think it's interesting to love the culture, hate the product, and want to make something that celebrates both of those feelings. And I think this movie does do that.
Yeah, right? And to do it in a way where I think it like even makes the audience question why we think certain things are good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you're watching this movie and you're like, oh, is he a soldier? I don't know. I don't like soldier stuff. Oh, he's just a bounty hunter. Oh, okay. That's totally different. The movie even has a debate in there inside of it. Like, mm-hmm. Okay, come on. Well, what is the difference between, you know, a soldier and a bounty hunter?
A lot of commotion in the streets.
Sure is. Looks like our islands are in for a change of government. If so, you bounty hunters will soon be outlaws.
Laws don't mean anything to a pig.
That's a good point. Don't mean much to us weapons dealers either.
Here are the bullets. You sure you want the usual? We've got new armor-piercing ones that explode on contact.
Hey, easy, kid. I'm just a bounty hunter. I'm not fighting a war.
Come again. So, what's the difference between fighting a war and bounty hunting?
If you make money from war, you're scum. But if you can't make money from bounty hunting, you're an idiot.
In terms of an answer, that's not like a really reassuring one, that a bounty hunter is just somebody mercenary who makes more money out of it and that's why it's fine. You know, but
yeah.
Like throughout this movie, there's just all these like elbows about like trying to understand for yourself what like freedom is for you. Like what is your goal?
Well, do you think that there's a little bit of a dichotomy between Porco and his main antagonist in this film? They have... Porco's human look is similar to the antagonist look. I think the reason why he's challenged or activated by this antagonist is not because he is truly wanting to show off his flying prowess, but I think it's because he wants to teach his old self a lesson.
Like, it's like battling this like Texas guy, Curtis, who, by the way, in like the actual Japanese, the subtitle says from Alabama. But if you watch the dubbed version where the great Cary Elwes is voicing Curtis, they changed him to Texas for some reason. I don't really know why. As a Texan, I'm like, what do you mean? What are you trying to say by changing him to Texas? Oh, wait, now I suddenly have a theory of why he's Texan. If this is coming out in, well, okay.
92.
Yeah, this is coming out in 92, but then the dub version Linklater is coming
fan.
Out later. I was wondering if it's a dig on George Bush, because you know I like to look for those.
I think that when you think about America and cocksure like thing, I think Texas feels right. Like that, like to me, it's not New York, it's Texas. It's like cowboy, right? Cowboy, and I think it's not even George Bush. I think it's just straight up cowboy. And that's a, you know, I think that that's a very stereotypical idea of like what, you know, if you're trying to say like, what is like the American man, you look at these shows, like whatever, Longmire and, you know, these, what's the big one that everyone loves
Longmire?
Right now? Isn't one of those shows, like Yellowstone, Longmire,
oh, yeah.
You know, all these, you know, I mean, obviously those are not all in Texas, but Tulsa King. With the great Southerner. Oh, Tulsa King is a brand new show with Sly Stallone, the most prominent Texan.
I thought you were just making up like Axe body spray scents and throwing them at me.
Now, Longmire is, you know, a book series that now is a movie
is?
Or TV show. Yeah, a drama series. you know about Yellowstone, okay. Though, right?
I've heard of it. But still, I mean, the point is he started it in Alabama and changed it to Texas.
I mean,
he picked Alabama in the beginning. So, you know, Alabama, sort of a deep cut.
Alabama, like, sure.
If you're like writing this movie in Japan.
Yeah, look, I get it. I quoted here, Longmire and Yellowstone and all that shit. It's like they're not like technically Texas shows, but there's like a cowboy nature to it. I think that Texas, kind of just answers all that sort of stuff. I mean, he doesn't look Texan to me. He doesn't even really truly look like an American to me. You know, like he is, but he looks more like Clark Gable, and I think they play into that idea that he becomes a movie star. And I would say he's more like Ronald Reagan, and they're kind of making that joke more than George Bush.
Yeah, that he's like an ambitious political guy who's going to be Ronald Reagan. I mean, what we know is like he's
ambitious, not even political. I think just ambitious and wants the fame and fortune and doesn't really think about at what cost. Whereas I think Porco is brought down by the cost of his actions.
That's fair. I mean, yeah, I think the ambition is the number one thing. Like, he wants to shoot down Porco just because he wants to be famous for killing him, which I think is, like, such a funny game plan. Like, I know how I'm going to be a movie star. I'm going to kill a pilot, and that will help ... make me a movie star. Murdering your way to fame. I mean, yeah, I feel like this is very much supposed to be about, like, Ronald Reagan. But I have to say, like, when he, you know, is like, I'm going to go back to America, and as a pilot, I'm going to run for office and I'm going to be president. The first thing I thought of watching this wasn't Ronald Reagan, but I thought of Charles Lindbergh and that whole kind of alternate history show, The Plot Against America, where Lindbergh returns to the States and like uses his fame as a pilot to become a fascist leader. Like, that almost seems to fit in this even better, because so much of this movie is about like F you fascists. I mean,
right.
Obviously, like, Porco gets the best line in all of that.
I gave him the slip.
You've got to get out of Italy now. I've seen your arrest warrant, deserting the Italian Air Force, entering the country illegally, being a blatantly unpatriotic pig. This is no time to laugh, Marco. They've got it in for you. They want to confiscate your plane.
Man, this movie stinks.
Marco, why don't you come back to the Air Force? I've got influence now. I could work something out.
Thanks for the offer, but I'd rather be a pig than a fascist.
I think what you said about being, I'd rather be a pig than a fascist, probably encapsulates this whole theme of this movie, you know, kind of perfectly. I know what I am. I'm not pretending to be something else. And that's what I think the fascists are pushing forward. And he's like, no, I am a fucking pig. Like, I know what I am, and I'll live with it, you know, because there's an energy around it. And there's a way that they all hold themselves. I'm proposing to a woman in a bar. There's a greed to it. They're working evil sides. Like they are hiding who they are. And he's never hiding. He's actually very publicly out. But that doesn't mean that as a pig, he also is pure, because I think one of the things he also wrestles with in this movie is misogyny, right? Like he's not a fully actualized person. Maybe in one element of his life he is, but like this idea that he didn't even want a woman working on his plane, you know, that this idea that he couldn't believe it wasn't about like, I'm afraid to ask for help. It's like, I don't want help from a woman. I mean, that's a very big part of this, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That whole fight that he has when he goes to Italy about just even having lady builders work on his plane.
Yeah.
Don't you have any male relatives?
All the men are gone. They have to look elsewhere for work.
This is work. Get them back.
Women are great. Don't be such a pig. You'll see. They're very hard workers.
Yeah, but we're not baking a cake here.
I mean, part of what I think is going on here, though, is, you know, if this is 1929, the Depression has just happened. So I feel like this is also Miyazaki's way of talking about the Depression without talking about the Depression, just like he seems to be like talking about World War II and how it's coming without talking about World War II. It's like he's made a movie that touches on these historical points that kids can see and feel the mood of without him totally getting into it. But since it is 1929, like, we hear that all the men are gone, and the men are gone because they have no work here. They have no money. And this movie is so much about money, like money being the motivator, inflation making his money worth nothing. And I think there's this interesting idea in here, you know, where, like, what are your images of being a pilot? You know, you think that, like, I'm a pilot, I have a plane. To us, I think the meaning of that is like freedom. You know, like being able to fly gives you like ultimate freedom. And these pilots all seem to talk a big game, you know, like, oh, we get to do our own thing. We're up in the air. But honestly, I think even in this movie, the freedom that all of the pilots seem to represent, you know, from the bad guys and the gangs to like Porco himself, they don't actually even have it. It feels kind of like an illusion. Like Porco has to take these jobs at the beginning because he has to make money to pay off his plane. He doesn't even own it. All of the other rival gangs are just broke. They don't have the money to fix their own planes either. Like, nobody has cash. And this idea of being, you know, beholden to banks and beholden to your own debts and, like, everything coming down to money at the end of it, that makes it feel like there is no freedom. I mean, the robbers can't even fly that far at their very beginning kidnapping because they don't have gas money, which is, like, so relatable right now.
Yeah. I feel like... You're right. You know, it's interesting, this we idolize a lot of things in culture that we don't look at the other side of. And you were talking about, like, you know, what, like, what's interesting about, you know, flying, and you're like, represents like a freedom. Well, sure, because we have movies like Top Gun, right? Top mm-hmm. Gun, I believe, made so many people want to become pilots because it was like a fucking ad for, you know, joining the military. But it wasn't like you're joining the military. It's like, you're going to be cool as shit. Like, you're going to throw on these glasses. You're going to get a cool nickname. Let's go for it. And we
enlistment. You know, the enlistment numbers are huge after Top Gun. Also, the Ray-Ban numbers are huge. Also, wait, do you remember the Tailhook Navy scandal where like a bunch of Navy guys went to, I think, Vegas and just groped all of the women?
Yes, yes, I remember that. My God, yeah. That
when I was researching my Tom Cruise book, like, I found like one of the Navy people, one of the officers, blamed Top Gun. He was like, all these fucking yahoos joined the Navy after Top Gun, thinking they'd be like romancing babes at the bar and wanting to live this like action movie lifestyle. And he's like, those are the dudes at Tailhook, man. Those are the dudes who are making us look bad.
Right.
But there's some of that here, too. I mean, like, all we keep hearing about Porco Rosso is that he's, like, such a womanizer, which we hear him, like, I don't know about it. Like, we hear him hit on a girl at the beginning.
What do you think his dick is like, Amy? Does he got pig dick, or does he have a human dick?
Oh, because I was just going to say curly and give you the anatomical answer, but...
Okay, I was going to... Like, that's what I thought, too. I was like, I really did think, does he have a curly dick? And I'm sorry to get...
Were you thinking that the whole time?
When they said he was a womanizer, it did cross my mind. I was like, well, he is fully realized as a pig. Does he have a curly dick? Is it part of the reason why he's a womanizer? Because people are just like, I got to check that out.
I mean, isn't a pig dick like very long proportionately?
Well, you know what? I feel like we're going to lose people on this conversation. Let's say everyone has got Google, figure it out. But
do you know why they're curly, by the way?
Why?
Okay. The reason that they're curly is that, like, in the whole genetic landscape of like female animals and male choice of mates and who they want to mate with, one of the adaptive things that women have come up with, you know, in their pig uterus, is like coming up with these kind of twisted wombs where it's almost like a maze, like the Shining maze, to get to the egg at the end, because they really want to challenge the sperm. It's been like this kind of arms race. Like, oh, I don't want just like any old pig to get me pregnant. Like, if you're going to get me pregnant, Mr. Pig, like, you better have the coolest sperm. It better be like top notch, because I'm not going to carry just anybody's baby. So like the female uteruses have gotten like really maze-like and complicated. And so the male penis of the pig has had to get more and more curly just to deal with it. It's like this total showdown of biological warfare.
Wow.
And that's the story. I mean, that's a story with like a lot of crazy penises in the animal world, you know, and that's, oh, like, if you get me started on like crazy animal penises, they're nuts. You know, there's like insects
Well, okay, well, now we got to get into it and just say, look, Josh has given us some more detail, too. The penis of a pig, long and rigid, has an S shape at its top half and an anti-clockwise spiral at the end. This is like basically a really complicated screw. It's about 300 to 500 millimeters long.
What's a millimeter? I'm an American.
Oh, well, you know, and I can't figure that out. And then it gets into some, it seems, I don't want to get into more detail than that. You can, again, get into it at home, figure out your own shit. But
what if Jack Nicholson had a pig dick to help him get out of the maze in The Shining?
Oh, boy. All right. No more of this. All right. So this movie, though, you know,
I'm just picturing him holding a pig dick like a dowsing rod, you know, like in a cartoon where it tells you where the water is.
Yes.
Like, what if that was the greatest way to help you when you got lost? Would you carry one in your pocket?
A pig dick? Sure. Well, I don't know if I'm getting lost that much. If I have a phone,
What if I took away your phone, but you could have a pig dick?
I don't know if I know, like, what north, south. I mean, I guess I'd have to.
The pig dick would know.
But I'm just saying, like, I don't even know what I would do with north, south, east, and west. Like, presupposes that, like, that's going to help me in some way.
What if you knew that the pig dick would take you home, but you had to just hold it really visibly and walk through, like, let's say 4 miles of Los Angeles?
Oh, I would be fine with that.
Yeah?
I'd be fine with that. Yeah. I mean, I'd hold it. I mean, it depends on what would it be in some sort of sack?
No, it'd be outward. And you'd have to wear a t-shirt that said, yes, this is a pig dick. Or ask me about my pig dick.
I got to look at it. I got to see how I'm holding it. I'm not adverse to it. I'm not freaked out about it. But again, this is a larger conversation that we have to have on our unspooled colon pig dicks, which is where we unspool all the stories about pig dicks, you know. So that is a whole different kind of unspooling here, not like a film reel.
I want to say thank you for bringing up this conversational detour.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
By the way, talking about kids' movies, I did find it interesting. I think that's probably more of a Japanese thing. Like, to have a main character in a movie smoke a cigarette was kind of shocking.
That's true. There is a ton of smoking in this movie. And wine drinking. Red wine drinking, white wine drinking.
Yeah.
Do you think he's a vegetarian? Do you think he eats bacon?
Oh, boy. I think he does. Yeah. I think his appetite is the same. He doesn't. He is a pig.
I think pigs eat pigs, don't they? Are pigs, like, cannibalistic?
I think pigs eat anything. But again, we don't need to get into all this pigs. I think we're losing track
But I am curious, because there is that part in The Wizard of Oz where Dorothy falls into the pigsty and she's like terrified and thinks they're going to kill her. And I have always wondered if pigs eat human flesh, pig flesh. Mm. Okay, let's go back to
again. I feel like it's not part of this story. Again, we get into it in our pig podcast. We can break it all down.
For as much as like Porco talks about himself as a womanizer, to your point, you know, like he calls himself a womanizer when he's trying to convince Fio not to come with him on his mission back from Italy.
I can handle that. I'm responsible for this plane, and I want to do my first job right.
Think about it. I'm a known womanizer. I'd live on a deserted island in a small tent.
That's great. I love camping.
That's not the point.
I kind of call it BS because you're right. We don't see him actually romance anybody I mean, he sort of hits on that one girl at the bar, right? Like, he's walking by her and she's like, tell me your story of what you did. And he's like, okay, well, I will when we're alone. That's just two of us.
Right.
But honestly, I mean, I don't know if he's ever going to take her up on that. Like, I don't know if he's secretly pining for Gina or he's just numb to the world. But it almost feels like he's burnishing his own womanizer reputation just to make more people leave him alone.
Here's what I'll say. I don't believe any of it. He is a man, pig, who is simply, there are stories about him because no one is connecting with him. They don't know him, right? We see him at his most unfettered, like we see where he lives. He's all by himself on this beach, alone, getting drunk. And he is not, I don't believe any of it. I think that people create stories about him. He is the Red Baron. You know, he is this other thing. We are scared of him. Because he has no connections and he is a pig, myths are built around him. But I don't think there is much more there.
I can see that. I mean, this is how Michael Keaton described him. You know, Michael Keaton doing the voice of him in the American dub.
Well, by the way, I started watching the American dub and I felt like it was really good. And then I'm like, I can't make the Akira mistake again. So I watched it subtitled. And I should have watched it dub. But I also hear that Miyazaki thinks that the best version of all the dubs is Jean Reno, who did the French version of this.
I mean, it's Jean Reno. He's amazing.
Of course.
He's amazing. Keaton's a little gruff. Is he Batman-ish? I don't know, but this is how he describes him.
How do you not do that? I mean, you just gotta do that, I think, don't you? But he's like a Bogart-type character. Kind of cynical, kind of tough guy.
Or maybe I'm dead and life as a pig is the same thing as hell.
When I watched it, I thought, this is so kind of fun and cool.
I'd be careful if you plan on making a deal.
It's just a little offbeat from what I think we're used to.
What did you think? I mean, did you have an issue with the subtitling? Like,
no,
watching the visuals and...
No, I mean, like, I got taken to task by some people, like, that I was an idiot for listening to the dub of Akira. But at the same time, you know, I made that choice. And then I also really loved what I was seeing. I remember watching the dub of Ponyo and going, oh, well, these are actors that I know giving like a really good performance. And I was really enjoying Porco with the Michael Keaton. I was like, you know what? Let me just watch it the other way. I don't want to fall victim to this twice. But yeah, I didn't like, there was something about Michael Keaton that felt a little bit too, it didn't match for me totally. I did
find,
you know, I found the Japanese performance to be a little bit more fitting.
Yeah, I felt like the Japanese performance had a bit more gravitas or something. There's something kind of watery Diet Pepsi to me in Michael Keaton's voice in this. And I say this loving Michael Keaton, but I didn't feel like he was totally right for this. Cary Elwes is Curtis. Funny.
Yeah.
I was into that. But yeah, I don't know. I think there needed to be more weight in Michael Keaton's voice.
I definitely buy that. I think that there, and it's interesting. I think that like, you know, I always am wondering who's directing these things. And is it just like, oh, Michael Keaton's a great voice for this, but it's not like they're not auditioning. They can't really like finesse it. It like there's a different version there. I like him as this character, like in the concept of him doing this. Brilliant. The execution, not as great, in my opinion. And it's funny that Cary Elwes is playing the American, you know, yeah. Anyway,
he's like British.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I wonder who would do a good job with a Porco voice. I mean,
well, Jean Reno is a great choice. Yeah. I do think Michael Keaton's a good one. But I do believe, you know, there's something about, or at least the way that animation is done now, where the voice informs some of the drawing at certain stages and the characters take on a life of their own. So I wonder if like Michael Keaton did get a chance to do that and they were drawing to him, if it would pop a little bit more. But you're right. Like, I think his performance overall was, you know, but I've seen him do this character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw a documentary about how they did the voices, and the main thing they talk about is just the difficulty in translating Japanese to English and then having to rewrite lines that fit what the mouth said. Like, they just kept talking a lot about the beats, but they didn't seem to talk a lot about the characterization. Except for the woman who played Gina, who talked a lot about what she thought Gina was like.
I think that people get too obsessed over lip flap in animation. Yeah. I think, if you know, like, how closely are we watching these lips? You know, to me, I'm just thinking we can fudge it a little bit.
Right. I'm like, that was
fudge it a little bit.
Yeah, fudge it up. Put some fudge in its mouth. It's fine. I did see when I was like searching for more information on it that people have turned like Porco Rosso's island into ASMR videos where you can like put on an image of his island and just hear a little bit of like the sea lapping if you want to zone out and meditate for an hour. It's very repetitive, but it sounds briefly like this.
Ooh, I like that.
It's mellow, right?
Very mellow.
By the way, I did go on kind of a strange tangent about flying pigs.
Okay.
Because I feel like, and I know I made my joke earlier at the show, my joke, like it was a hilarious thing to say. My reference to idioms and the idiom, like pigs have wings, which is such a common phrase here, like in the English language. I think that phrase shows up in the English language sometime around the 1500s, mm-hmm. This idea of pigs having wings. And I feel like if an American or an English speaking artist had made this, they would make it knowing that that's like an idiom here, like the idea of like when a pig flies, anything is like crazy. Nothing is possible. It's a thing that will never happen. But I feel like Miyazaki makes this film kind of without really consciously having this history of it as an American idiom.
Right.
Because
yes.
It's like,
when pigs fly, he wasn't thinking, oh, that's great. But I will say that some of the advertising definitely caught on to that because, you know, like some of the taglines for the film, and these are the Japanese taglines, a pig who doesn't fly is just an ordinary pig. Which
yes.
Kind of I feel like is a little bit of a tip of that. But I also love this tagline, which is a decidedly Japanese tagline, in my opinion. And I apologize if this is coming across from a too much of an American point of view, but this is what it means to be cool. Like that to me is like a perfect Japanese tagline.
That just doesn't seem like what the movie's about at all.
No, it seems to me like, and by the poster and everything, again, this movie does have a chance to glorify that thing. It's about a hero who flies a cool plane. He is helped by a really smart girl. But it's like I think kids can look at it and go, here's a great guy. He was shot down. He comes back. It follows the rules of very classic storytelling, right?
Yeah.
But I think what we're talking about is this much more layered, nuanced plot underneath the surface. And I think it's the reason why Miyazaki thinks this movie is not going to work. Like, people don't want to see this. But then it becomes this giant hit. You know, it becomes this movie that people really connect to. And I think, going back to what we originally started out talking about, this idea that when an adult can walk away from a movie that may be viewed as a children's movie, feeling that there is a deeper connection to it, you're going to get this audience to come with you. Like, this is, you know, this not only cements Miyazaki as a great animator, but as the kind of just like a hit maker, whatever he does, we're going to get a hit.
I mean, because honestly, he'd already done Totoro before this and Totoro had not been such a big hit. Like, this is one of the movies that sustains his career so that people go back and then they discover his earlier movies like Kiki's and Totoro. You know, this really grounds him. And it's interesting, like the comic book, you know, this is based on like a really short 15-page comic book that he did ahead of time. The comic book gets even a little bit more into kind of the murky stuff he's talking about. Like there's a little scene in there where the character talks about how bad he feels that he really prefers German machine guns when he knows that they're German and like, oh, it sucks, but they are the best machine guns. I do really like them. And he gets into, you know, some of the digs on America that I think are totally fair. He says like, what he loves about the kind of curvy, strange, loony design on this of Porco's plane, which is inspired by real planes, that it is like Italian craftsmanship. It's got like this style and it's not what he calls quote unquote American rationalism, as in the planes that he thinks came out of America in this time favored, you know, just like mechanics over beauty. I think he loves the beauty of it, which is why he has like planes that are painted like polka dots and like rainbow colors and like sherbet. And they're so beautiful, the planes that he uses in this movie. I mean, it's weirdly cheerful. That's one of the things I think just pops out about it, like straight away. That this is a movie about all these serious ideas, but it's also just like bright and colorful. Like, his pitch when he wanted to do this movie first is just a short thing for Japan Airlines was not that he was making a movie for kids. He said his target audience was tired businessmen on long flights. And so he wanted to turn their boring flight into a dream. You know, he wanted to make a film. These are the parameters that he set up for himself. He wanted to make a film that was cheerful, but not rowdy, dynamic, but not destructive, romantic without lust, set in a world that is incredibly bright and beautiful. And he just makes you like accept this tone straight away. I mean, the movie starts, there's a kidnapping. We've seen this Liam Neeson movie like 90 times. But what you don't see is the kids just being like, oh, this is cute. This is fun. We're taking over the plane. And the kidnappers themselves seeming kind of adorable. Take all of the kids.
Are you seaplane pirates?
That's right.
So we're your hostages?
That's right, too.
Smells like you never bathe.
You're shocked.
How cute. Could use some blood.
Hey, hey. Come on, kids. We're in a hurry.
Boss, do we have to take all 15 of them?
Yeah, it's not nice to separate them from their friends.
I love the kidnappers. One of them reminded me of Bluto from Popeye. Like, they had this, like, really, I mean, the fact that they're kidnapping kids and you're kind of okay with it and the kids are swimming, like, that opening sequence really is a different film, but it captures the fun of the movie, and I think it has a different weight. But I do think this is something that he wrestles with, because I want to just go back briefly to what you said about it being based on a comic book. The comic book really was much more of a fun story. It was, you know, back in 84, it's about a military officer who is a pig who leaves command. He builds a tank and he's going out there for fun and glory. He kidnaps a young woman and tries to seduce her. And, you know, and he was like, oh, well, you know, should they fall in love? But then he was like, oh, I don't know. You know, he was like it was a weirder story. It was a much more, I think, you know, like Fortune and Glory kind of like, I think more of an Indiana Jones story than it was this story about what I think you succinctly said. I'd rather be a pig than a fascist, which is interesting. I wonder if like wrestling with it more and letting those 10 years like kind of percolate, like he created something and he's like, I want to do something a little bit deeper than that.
Yeah. And he's got all these little asides in the original comic that make you see how much he sees this as an anti-war, anti-fascist movie. Like, you know, there's that little sort of cross sign on the back of Porco's plane. And he does this right in the margins. Like, he draws that cross and then he draws the fascist cross. And he's like, this is not the same cross. I want to be very clear. These are different crosses. And he even adds, like, I don't even like drawing this fascist cross. I hate even making this cross. And so he's like building in this whole world to kind of talk about this political stance that he really wants to make with this film, which to me is something that I find like interesting just as a challenge. Like, can you make a film about like a fighter in a plane and the military that is not like a pro-military film, right? It's like really hard to do that. Like, can you make a film where any hero goes up in sort of a military plane or there's a military vibe and it doesn't wind up feeling like the military is great? And I think that is his challenge here that he really tries to do.
Yeah, I do think it's hard. I think that's a hard thing to do because whenever your hero looks really good, you know, not only does Porco look great flying the plane, but he looks great as a character, as a pig. Like, you want to be the pig. It's hard. I think it's hard to balance these ideas because inevitably you are showing...
Right.
You are glorifying something. I think it's impossible not to glorify it.
Right.
But I don't know if that's bad. That's it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, like when we were talking about Akira, you know, we mentioned how the very first feature-length Japanese animated film was all about cute animals becoming suicide parachute jumpers.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that would have been like a film that opened right when he was a baby, you know, that he would definitely be aware of as somebody who'd worked in like animation from the time he was a kid. And it feels incredibly serious to him to make a film about this that doesn't encourage people to sign up like they did at Top Gun.
Right.
You know, because honestly, even later on, like there was a moment where the Japanese government was considering amending the constitution so that they would kickstart having an army again. And Miyazaki was one of the really outspoken critics of that. Like, absolutely not. Do not change the constitution. This country does not need that military force back. We don't need that kind of like weaponized nationalism. Like, he is passionately against making anything that could be interpreted as a pro-war film.
So you would say this is not a pro-war film.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But I do feel like it's also a movie that doesn't lie and say a good guy can prevent a war, that war doesn't have to happen. Like, it kind of puts a human life or a pig life into scale. Like, Porco can't stop what's coming. He can just, like, hide out from it, you know? Like,
yeah.
And I respect that because that feels like a difficult thing to say. I mean, Miyazaki said while he was making this film, he had a realization about what is it like to be alive during complicated times. And what he said is, you know, no matter how messy things get, we have no choice but to go on living. And that is the setup for Porco. Here he loves this character who's alive when a war is about to start. And what do you do? Well, he's going to have to live through it.
Right. And do you think that going back to the light, like, what do you think goes on for Porco after this? Do you think that he goes back into the world or, you know, because obviously he's hiding, but we don't really know, right? We don't really know exactly where he moves from, like what he moves to.
I mean, I think he eventually goes back and, you know, romances Gina. You know, I really do think so. I mean, and here's why, because there is that epilogue at the end where Fio's telling us everything that happens and a little cryptic, you know, she doesn't quite say. She says she leaves that up for us to find out later.
Through the years, there have been a few wars and a good deal of turmoil, but my friendship with Gina has remained strong. I am now president of the Piccolo Company, and we're busy designing all sorts of radical new planes, but I take time out every summer to visit the Hotel Adriano. The old pirate gang still hang out at Gina's bar.
But around when she's saying exactly what she's saying there about, like, her and Gina becoming friends, you know, she does that pan over the hotel. And if you look very closely at the very end of this island hotel, you see Porco's red plane parked all by itself at, like, a secret little ramp that would lead up to her garden. And so she kind of lets you know that that's where he is.
Do you think that that's a perfect relationship? Because in a way, I guess what I'm thinking is she keeps on losing pilots in her life, the men that she loves. And it feels to me like he may not be a pilot anymore. He's done flying. Like, this was his last hurrah.
I wonder. I mean, I wonder if he's not a pig anymore.
Well, I definitely wondered about that, too. Like, did this break his... You know, it would have been interesting to know, like, if he stopped flying, if he became a human again. I think,
yeah.
I mean, there's no allusion to that. Maybe it's just your own idea, but I do think that there's something there that you could make that argument that, like, you kind of long for that one image where you see, there's a moment, right? There's a moment in the movie where the young girl is with him. She looks at him by the fire and sees his real face, right? And in that moment, is she seeing him for who he actually is? In this moment of, like, he is being open. He doesn't have his walls up. There is something to be said for, like, there is no curse. He has made himself a pig because he doesn't know how to interact with the world without being a pig, like putting these walls up. The pig is a wall to keep people away. And in that moment, that drops, you know, because no one's around, or he thinks no one's around.
Yeah, as in, it's not so important that he looks in the mirror and he sees a pig. It's important that when other people look at him, they see a pig.
Right.
You know, it's like warning other people how he thinks of himself on the inside.
Well, I think part of it is, like, it keeps people away. Like, if you make yourself ugly, you keep people away. Right.
Yeah.
On some level, like, he's not that ugly people don't have friends. But, like, if you view yourself as ugly, then you view yourself as somebody that doesn't deserve love or attention or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I think there's an element of that, too.
Or you could say he's reflecting back to humanity what he thinks of them.
Mm.
You know, because Miyazaki himself, like, he talks a lot about his own sort of self-righteousness and anger. Like, and maybe Miyazaki is being really critical to himself, you know, but he says that, you know, he's a person who really believes, like, that this is what's right and this is what's not right. And he kind of walks through the world and that he has this tendency to being a very angry man. But that the way that he tries to calm his anger is by reminding himself that human beings are foolish. And it's like thinking of them as foolish people, but not enemies, is what I think helps him diffuse.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if, like, the pigness is making fun of humanity, kind of like saying, this is all very silly. You're aware this is all very silly, what you think and what you're doing and why you're doing it, chasing paper money, all of it, you know, war, nobility, fascism, like loyalty to your country. It's all a little bit silly. And I do wonder if he puts it down at the end when, like, Curtis looks at him and it says, like, let me see your face. Like, what is going on with your face? And Curtis seems to see him as the human too.
Yeah, you're right. So maybe it's the way that we view ourselves is the way that we carry ourselves to the outside world.
Yeah, because I would say that Porco does not like himself, right?
Yeah, no, he definitely doesn't. But he also, I think he still carries the guilt of it should have been me. Like, this is what I'm like, it should have been me. So he's punishing himself instead of being thankful. I think that grief and trauma can paint you in a way where you can make your life so unlivable that it's almost as if you're dead. And part of that journey of the people that I know and I've seen is, how do you carry grief in a way where you still carry on with your life? You hold the people that you love that have passed in high regard, but also understand that no one would want you to be sacrificing your own life. Like, you're here for a limited amount of time. At least enjoy it. You did get out. Like, and I think that's a hard thing to wrestle with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely here. Yeah, there's that whole debate in the middle of the film. You know, like, is Porco alive or is Porco dead? And when he sees the headlines himself, he's like, I don't even know. It makes me feel like he's wrestling with how alive he even wants to be. And there's such a, I love that beautiful sequence when he's talking about that flashback to the war and the fight where all of his friends died. And he talks about, like, flying up into those kind of milky clouds. And then he sees that asteroid belt almost of, like,
yeah,
his fellow dead pilots, like, flying forever in eternity, which is kind of a beautiful image, at least in the afterlife. They're doing what they love, but it's also haunting, and they're in lockstep, and nobody's, like, diving or swirling or having fun. They're just kind of going forth really uniformly. But that music in that scene, you know, as he's, like, calling out to his friend that he lost, like, Bellini, that music is so gorgeous.
Bellini, I thought you were dead. Come back here. Where do you think you're going?
This whole soundtrack, this whole score is just beautiful. But I love that shot in particular, and the way the music goes with it.
Absolutely.
You know, by the way, did you know that this film was actually initially rejected for being distributed in the United Kingdom, like, right when they first tried to offer it around?
No.
Because in this, like, post-Akira world, this company was like, this is not anime. Real anime has sex and violence. And if this doesn't have enough sex and violence to be anime, so no thank you, we're not interested, nobody cares.
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's wild. They wasn't extreme enough. But I can't imagine that most people felt that way. I mean, I imagine that this movie, you know, connects. Although it is interesting that it is not, again, I am no Miyazaki expert, but it is not one of the films that I have heard of in even, I would say, the top five. It was interesting that it was in our poll after we eliminated the two most recognizable ones, or the two biggest ones, that this one popped up. I was really fascinated by that.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if part of why Porco Rosso is, I think, getting its due more and more is because when he went on and made, like, The Wind Rises in 2014, I think people really, really had to understand how much this moment in time and aviation in general, like, meant to him. You know, like, if you love Miyazaki and you want to understand him, this is not his autobiography, but it is the self-portrait of the things that he obsesses over and frets over and worries and, like, you know, chews over and tries to do right. And I think it's just, I mean, I love all his films. This is not a diss on any of his films. But it is easy to have, like, a cute cat and a little girl running around and make something adorable. Like, those are adorable. They're very cute and popular and wonderful to watch for a reason. But I'm glad we did this one because I think it's a deeper window into his soul.
I agree. I think it's, I always think it's a very interesting way to look at a filmmaker when they get to make a film that is something a little bit closer to their heart. And a lot of the times this idea, I talk about this on How Did This Get Made all the time, that a passion project sometimes is a failure because you're so excited to finally make it. And you've been told so many times that you forget like why your other films have been good and the collaborations have been good, or maybe the idea was faulty, or you don't ever tweak it in a certain way. But this is a different version of that. This is a very well executed film that also is, it feels like a passion project. It feels like an intentional detour that in his mind, he took his shot. Like that podcast, Blank Check, is so, I love that podcast. But the idea like, well, I have a blank check now. I can go and make the thing I want to make. And this is kind of, it feels like this is the thing that he wanted to make and he wasn't sure it was going to work. And the fact that it actually did work, and even the way he went about it, like, well, I'll make it as an airplane thing. I'll make it as a comic book. I'll make it as an airplane. You know, it's like, and it just grew and grew and grew. It's a very interesting evolution of this idea that he was able to make something at the, not the height, but at a moment where I guess no one was going to question him. And then it worked. And then I think the gates are open from there on forward, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is definitely how I would put it. Yeah. It's wonderful. You know, I went on a whole detour, by the way, about pigs and flying that I have to just share with you. Did you know that the very first Englishman to fly an airplane, a man with a very complicated name, Lieutenant Colonel John Theodore Cuthbert Moore Brabazon, also known as the Lord Brabazon of Terra, not only was he the first Englishman to fly an airplane, in 1909, he was the first person to put a pig in air. He flew a pig in an airplane in a little basket, and the basket had a sign on it saying, "This is the first pig to fly," as a way of saying, "I am now a pilot. We are doing the impossible. The aviation moment is here."
Wow. All right.
Isn't that cool?
I love that.
And I would be remiss if I didn't just like talk about like every pig who's ever flown, which is a lot. Okay. I won't do
Wait,
all of
there's
them.
A lot of pigs that have flown. I did. All right. Well, because I guess we're talking about this idea. Like people just want to do that. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Okay.
I mean, deliberately just want to prove it. They want to prove that this is the weird thing that you can do. I mean, of course, there are people doing it, you know, for their own, you know, mental health reasons.
Megan Peabody is packing for a quick getaway vacation, and she's not traveling alone. The 28-year-old is heading to Miami with her pet potbelly pig named Hamlet. The ticket agents at American Airlines sure are surprised as they look over Megan's documentation, certifying Hamlet as an emotional support animal.
The kids in the hall, top 10 famous flying pig. It was the pig who flies to, like, entertain you when you're in line?
Yes, yes.
Hey, everybody, look! It's the flying pig!
Oink, oink! Hello, everybody!
Whee!
Hello, flying pig!
And it's been so long since we did a Simpsons, but the Simpsons have maybe my favorite flying pig. You remember the episode where Lisa is a vegetarian and Homer happens to be like barbecuing a pig with a pig on its mouth, and she takes the barbecue cart and she like runs away with it and tries to free it, and it winds up blasting into the space. Do you remember this?
No, I don't.
Oh, I'm jolting your memory. Here you go.
All right.
It's just a little airborne. It's still good. It's still good.
It's good.
I know.
You know, Smithers, I think I'll donate $1 million to the local orphanage. When pigs fly...
That's a good one. Will you be donating that $1 million now, sir?
No, I'd still prefer not.
By the way, as weird as, like, pigs have wings, you know, which is the way they phrase it in, like, Alice in Wonderland, when pigs fly, blah, 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 as weird as that is as a maxim, the Russians on this one have us beat. Because their version of this phrase is, when the crayfish will whistle on the mountain.
Oh, I like that. I mean, that, I'm going to start saying that. When the crayfish whistle, when the crawdads sing and the crayfish whistle,
on the mountain.
I know, I was Americanizing it. I guess, what, how did critics view it?
Critics didn't really review it very much. It didn't make a ton of a splash. And the ones who did liked it. Like, I could not find a negative review for this movie, but I do think it says something that when that when Miyazaki tried to talk about this same conversation again, about like people who get involved in war and can you be a non-political person at a time where the world is like going to hell, or is it even okay to be a non-political person? When he tries to get into all of this in 2014 with The Wind Rises and is like his animated movie about Jiro Horikoshi, you know, the Japanese engineer, he was criticized from all flanks, you know, like it. He has not been able to talk about this without like taking on a ton of criticism in the 2000s that he did not get when this movie came out in the 90s. Like he was criticized on really every direction for making a movie that like was, you know, tender and respected the artistry of a person who was making planes that did wind up killing a bunch of people. He really couldn't win having this conversation anymore. Like, you know, he was criticized by not showing enough of the actual atrocities that the Japanese did on the war on one side. And he was criticized by conservative Japanese people as making a film that they considered to be anti-patriotic.
Oh, wow.
And he was also criticized by the medical establishment for having his characters continue to be smoking. So it has become a little harder to talk about the complexity as he sees it. And the fact that even in here, his good guys do bad things and his bad guys are sort of lovable to children and like, he doesn't seem like he thinks there is clear moral villains and victims in the world. And it's difficult to talk about it. It's really difficult to try to put some shade into his animation.
Did they talk about pig dicks in there?
No, he didn't. But he, if he does do a sequel, I'm sure that you can ask him.
All right, great. I think that that's good. Well, Amy, you know what? This flying cool pig has made me, you know, feel the need
for
to
pig
do. No, Amy, I was going to say I have the need to revisit Top Gun 1 in honor of Top Gun Maverick coming out. Not even a sequel. But we thought this would be fun to take a break from our month of animation to kind of honor a classic that we talked about here that we've actually kind of said is responsible for a lot of bad things in the general sense that it got people involved in a lifestyle that they didn't quite fully understand. But I do think there's a lot of energy going on about Top Gun Maverick. It seems like the biggest movie of the summer. Doctor Strange, Top Gun 2, and Thor are like the three big blockbusters that we have coming up. And what's interesting about this one is while it is a sequel, again, it's something that does feel different. And Top Gun, I think, feels different. It's not about superheroes. It's not a giant franchise. And I would argue that most people seeing Top Gun Maverick are going to be unfamiliar with the first film. I think it's geared to a new audience. It has to be on some level, right? Don't you think? Because to me, it looks like, yes, it's called Top Gun Maverick, but it doesn't feel like it's called Top Gun 2. Like it feels like it is trying to make a new thing. We got the new, young, hunky people in it. We got Lady Gaga. This is not about like a bunch of old guys getting up in planes. So I do think that there is, I mean.
You mean it's not like what, Space Cowboys?
Yeah.
Okay, I will say this. You know, maybe the illusion is it's like The Color of Money when Cruise did The Color of Money after he did Top Gun, which I would not have known was a sequel to The Hustler.
That's what I kind of think it is. Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's like, because this movie came out in 86. Top Gun came out in 1986. People may know it, but I think that we live in a culture where people don't know anything. It's like, I always remember when people said, oh, Eddie Murphy used to do like adult movies. And it's like, oh yeah, that's the world that we live in. Like it's only what you've just seen that person do.
She was in a writing room where none of the younger people in the writing room knew that Jared Leto used to be Jordan Catalano.
Wow. There you go.
That made me want to die.
So this is what we're talking about. We're going to go back, get ready for Top Gun Maverick by watching Top Gun. You can get Top Gun wherever you stream your films, and I'm sure on a discount because at this point they want to probably get people watching both back to back, maybe out of order. But take a listen to the trailer.
I'm going to send you up against the best.
Yes, sir.
You two characters are going to Top Gun.
I feel the need. The need for speed.
For 5 weeks, you're going to fly against the best fighter pilots in the world.
You guys really are cowboys.
I don't like you because you're unsafe.
That's right.
I am dangerous.
The wild card. Flies by the seat of his pants.
I guess when I see something, I go right after it.
It takes a lot more than just fancy flying.
Gentlemen, this school is about combat. There are no points for second place.
Figured it out yet? What's that? He's the best pilot.
No, I think I can figure that one out on my own.
Tom Cruise, Kelly McGillis, Top Gun.
All right, Amy, are you ready to salute a different side of a fighter pilot's journey?
Am I ever? Are you kidding me? Do you know how much I have waited to do a Tom Cruise movie on this show?
Oh my gosh, it's our first Tom Cruise. This is a real first Miyazaki, first Tom Cruise. And we are, what, 4 years into this show? Oh my God.
The world so of many cinema. Firsts. So huge.
I like this comparison, though, of Porco and Top Gun back to back. It'll be interesting to watch. And I'm actually very excited to watch Top Gun again. I haven't watched it in years.
Oh, I have so many opinions on Top Gun. It is on.
I can't wait. That's all for today's show. And remember to rate and review this show. Tell people about it. It really, truly helps. A big thank you to our super producer, Josh Richmond, and our audio engineer extraordinaire, Devin Bryant. Thank you guys for making this show sound so amazingly great. And our MVP behind the scenes, Molly Reynolds, for making sure that this show runs on time and that we have our research at hand. I also want to give a shout out to Kim Troxell for her amazing art. And if you want to keep this conversation going, please do so at discord.gg/Paul Scheer. There's an unspooled section there where we have debates and votes and polls. We also have our Facebook group, the Unspooled Podcast Facebook group, that is still an amazing place to be. I want to give a huge shout out to everyone in all those forums for keeping these conversations going. And I also want to let you know that you can head on over to tpublic.com to check out our Unspooled merch. That's right. Go to tpublic.com/stores/unspooled to see what we got in the store. And that's all. We'll see you next week on Unspooled.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.